listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast with your host, Andy Plimer. Bringing you up-to-date coaching concepts from the world of rugby. Sharing ideas to make the game better.
All right, welcome to episode number 69 of the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. I'm your host, Andy Plimer, and joining me today is Chris Stafford. Chris has been coaching rugby for around 10 years now and is full-time rugby development officer at Leeds Beckett University, as well as head coach at Old Otleyensians, RUFC, in Otley, West Yorkshire. Chris recently completed a postgraduate degree in sports coaching and applies a lot of the theory and concepts to his daily coaching environments. He and his fellow coaches at Old Otley, I'll just call it, you can correct me later, recently won the Coaching Moment of the Year 2018 at the UK Coaching Awards. It's a pleasure to have him on the show, so welcome, Chris.
Thanks, mate. It's good to be here.
Yeah, no worries. 69 podcasts, and I've never had a rugby club name stump me as bad as that one. What's the story there?
You're not the only one. There's quite a few people that even when we were going for the awards that still couldn't say it. It's just because it's linked to the old grammar schools in the town.
Right.
So there's a few clubs around Yorkshire that have got names like that. So yeah, it's just, if you just remember Otley and then Ensians at the end, and then it's a bit easier to say.
All right, no worries. I'll see how I go. All right, well, it's good chatting with you. What's a bit of a backstory of your playing and coaching?
I wasn't a particularly great player. Growing up, I played age grade, county stuff, and for my local club at Stockton. And then I went to university at York St John, and when I was 18, 19, did my ACL. So I was out of the game from playing for a while. So really wanted to stay involved. That's when I started doing my coaching badges.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved to Leeds in 2009. Continued to play at Ilkley Rugby Club. Played in Yorkshire One there and got to the national final at Twickenham with them as a player. And then in 3 years there, I started as a player coach at West Park Leeds and done some other stuff in between, sort of county stuff with Yorkshire, a lot of ladies stuff. And coached the women's team at Leeds Beckett as well for 3 years. So I've got a bit of a vast coaching background from clubs. And then I worked for the RFU for 10 years as a community rugby coach as well.
Right.
So I do England Rugby Coaching Awards, level ones, level twos, referee stuff as well. So it's, yeah, rugby's been a big part of my life so far. And all that experience I try and put into my coaching when I'm out there.
Yeah, sweet. And what about those? I'm interested in those early experiences, especially the player coach one, because that's how I started as well. What were some of those early experiences from, and what were some of the biggest learnings, biggest mistakes, those kind of things?
Well, I found the player coach role really difficult. I don't know what you thought,
but
I found transitioning that sort of leadership role and knowing what you're meant to be doing and what you expect other people to be doing. And I found that really impacted on my game.
Mm.
And I don't think I played my best rugby that I could have done during them years that I was doing both, because I think the decision-making that I was going through was more of a coach than as a player. And I don't think I presented myself at my best then. I think I'd always struggle to... I wouldn't really do that again. I mean, I don't play now because I've done my knee again. But if I was still playing, I don't think I'd ever do a player coach role again. I just found it really difficult to manage it, and I think that stressed me out more than anything else.
I say it was horrible, but that's a bit tongue in cheek, because I actually found I did it for 3 years, and I actually think it expedited my growth as a coach. But you have to be self-reflective. You have to look at yourself and say, ooh, that wasn't a good day in the office. And I actually, the best I was at was when I sought some help from a sports psychologist and just talked to her about, okay, how do I step away from being coach and just being player? And that when I did that and I was able to do that, that really, really powered me on a bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm reflecting, I was probably too young to maybe do that sort of role then. You know, I was 27.
Yeah.
And I think I would probably be in a much better position with my knowledge from my master's and doing my level three to probably manage that a little bit better. But yeah, it was probably one of the hardest parts of my coaching journey was managing both them roles. I mean, one of the most biggest learning I found was when I was coaching in the women's game.
Mm-hmm.
I just found that the girls I was working with at Leeds Metropolitan University at the time, now Leeds Beckett, we had a few of the England girls were involved in the team. So there was Vicky Fleetwood and Emily Scarrett, who are internationals now. You know, they're always, in a positive way, asking lots of questions about, you know, why we were doing stuff, what the plan was, why were we doing this exercise, what was the learning moment, what was the action that was coming from it. And I just found that then made me plan that a little bit better. It made me be aware of what I wanted to get a little bit better, because I knew I was going to get asked these questions and I needed to make sure I had the answers for them.
Yeah.
So I never found that as a threat, but I found it actually probably brought the best out of me about how I use questions, how I work towards a learning outcome, and how I build the planning of my sessions.
Yeah.
And I think that really, for off the field stuff, that really focused my attention on how I plan and what the actual objectives were, rather than just being a bit ad hoc with stuff. But that was a real powerful learning moment for me about how I plan and make sure I'm aware of myself, what I actually want to achieve.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think, you know, you just raised the point there, the more diverse of the coaching experiences we get, whether it be coaching kids, being a player coach, coaching women, coaching men, you have to consciously do it, but you can take away so many lessons from each of those experiences and just add it to the bank.
100%. That's what I mean. I've been doing while I was doing my master's, I was doing some teaching on the undergrad sports coaching degree here at Leeds Beckett. And one of the things I always used to tell the first year students is, you know, you're here to coach, get out and practice. And you know, my 9-10 years in the RFU, I was coaching in every different environment within a week that you'd expect. On a morning, I could be doing some tag rugby in a school, and then the evening I'd be in a club session working with adults. And you've really got to, it really challenges you to put your different hat on for different environments. And if you're aware of how you can adapt to each of them, and you can have a clear, you know, you don't just use the same style for everything. You know, that can really help you being aware of working in them different environments. I found that really, I was coaching every day different, and I think that's really got me to a point where I can, you know, drop into any environment now and probably deliver a session quite quickly and not feel threatened by it.
Cool. Oh, that's awesome. All right. Now, you know, old Otley-Enzians, did I get that right?
Yeah, you got that right.
Sweet. So what's, you touched a little bit on the history of the club. What's it going into a bit more detail? What's where's it positioned? What league's it playing in? Those kind of things.
So we're currently sat in Yorkshire 2, which is level 8 of the Northern Division.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's 8 leagues below the Premiership.
Yeah.
Last year we were in level 9, so we got promotion. Senior on the club, there's 2 clubs in Otley. So there's Otley Rugby Club, which is in National 2.
Mm-hmm.
So they're playing on quite a high-profile level for them. And they've got the junior section and everything else. And we're just a senior only club with a group of local lads that sort of went to school with each other.
Right.
It's a very family orientated club, and it's a really good environment to be around. The club's run by volunteers, and each of them volunteers wants to make sure that the club is always going to be able to survive, whether that's, you know, volunteers coming to run the kitchen, volunteer staff behind the bar. The Monday club come down and clean up after everyone on a Monday. So it's a real community club based on volunteers, and it's real heart of the community. That's what we're trying to be.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. And yeah, it's like, yeah, I've heard of Otley Rugby in the National 2. I think one or two Canadians might have popped in there for a few stints. Yeah, it's so key for our game to have clubs like your club in all over the world. That there's a place for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, Otley is run, you know, they've got a set of volunteers that run all their coaching and their committees and stuff like that. And you know, they've done well to keep playing at the level that they do. I mean, we're quite fortunate in some respects that a lot of our lads that are playing actually live in Otley. A lot of lads come from outside of town to play for Otley Rugby Club. And, you know, they fly the flag. They get in Otley on the map, as it were, in the level that they're playing at. And then we can offer another playing opportunity at that lower level for the lads that do want to take the rugby a little bit seriously, but socially at the same time, which is, I think, you know, it's good that two clubs in a small town can work well like that.
Yeah, that's great. All right, well, you touched on it there briefly. You had a great 2018 season. Before we get into the details of that season, can you paint a little bit of a picture in terms of what the previous season was like, what in 2017? And what were some of the post kind of season reflections that that you feel really kicked on in 2018?
Well, last year was actually my first year at the club.
Right.
I sort of took a year out from club coaching when I left West Park just to focus on my masters and get myself sort of right in that point of view. But I've always known about the club from working in the area.
Right.
I always knew that there was a lot of players there that were talented from the schools program that they come into, and that they were probably, I would say, you know, playing a level lower than they could have. And I found out in the March time that they were looking for a coach, and I approached the club about myself about taking over because I knew it would be quite an exciting project. I sent them my CV at the time, and I'll never forget the treasurer got a Gordon sent me one back saying, "Chris, I'm not sure we can afford you. I think you're ever qualified to come here." But I said to him, "I'm actually surprisingly quite cheap. I just really see this as an exciting project to be part of." And I knew what they had. I knew that there were a group of lads that went to school with each other, so they already had a little bit of a culture. They had that relationship between themselves. I just knew they needed some guidance. But you know, you look at that year, they finished ninth in the league. They conceded 511 points but scored 657.
Right,
scoring more than they were conceding. And they'd won the Yorkshire Silver Trophy, which is what qualified them for the Twickenham run.
Right.
So I kind of knew that all of this was in the pipeline. So I knew that there was a bit of an incentive there for the players. I knew that would be a good potential recruitment tool as well. And it was a good opportunity to maybe help them kick on to that next level. So that's sort of what inspired me to really want to get back into club coaching with an exciting project. That's what I needed. I needed a bit of a motivation to go and do it, and that got me a little bit excited.
Yeah.
So that was sort of that picture, and then we went into the start of the 2017-18 season off with a sort of a bit of a good run from there, really. But it was all the foundations that the coach at the time, John Walker, that he'd sort of laid. He brought the club back from Yorkshire 4, where they were struggling for numbers. But he said he took them as far as he could take them, and that's why he was sort of stepping aside, and I felt I could do that job of taking him to that next level.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that's right. So you got split seasons, right? So that was before you came on board. It was 2017-18, and then was it
2016-17,
and then 2017-18 was the... one. So in 2017-18, your fellow coaches, the club, were awarded the Coaching Moment of the Year 2018 at the UK Coaching Awards. Can you tell us a little bit about the award? But just before we kind of go into the actual season, what's that award represent? How's that run and chosen?
Yeah, well, every year UK Coaching want to recognise great coaching, and they do that with their yearly awards. It's quite a prestigious event down in London, and every sports represented, and there's some really good stories about other coaches that were on that day. The award kind of took, especially us in Otley, as a little bit of a surprise. It was a local person who nominated us for the award. It was a new award run by UK Coaching that year. And she wanted us to have some recognition for what she felt we'd done to the town, with us getting through to the final, and we had the semi-final where, you know, 800 people came down to show their support, which is it's mad that we had that many people come and just watch us play against Eccles Hall in the semi-final. That was for the lads. She, I can't remember the lady's name now, but she nominated us for the award. So there was myself, Harrison Marshall, and Steve Quinn for the award. And then I got an email at the middle of October just saying that we'd been nominated for this award. the information was embargoed, so we couldn't tell anyone, but congratulations, and more information will come out on the Monday. So on the Monday, I'm sat in the, I was actually at the doctor's waiting for my appointment, and I got a message off one of my lecturers with a screenshot of who we were nominated against. And it kind of like unbelievable, really, because you just like, hang on, what's going on here? This can't be right. And we were nominated against, obviously, Gareth Southgate, the England football manager, and Tracy Neville, the England netball coach, for obviously the World Football World Cup performance, and Tracy Neville with the England netball winning gold for the first time at the Commonwealth Games. And you go, hang on, what's going on here? How's this happened? And that was up until a public vote as well.
Wow.
And again, you know, the three of us really want to have a lot to thank Otley for. I think the whole town must have got up and voted for us, because how we managed to beat them, two great moments on their own is quite an achievement. And I think it's a positive for grassroots sport.
Absolutely.
You know, we do have it. Steve mentioned it when we were on stage, and when we got the award, is, you know, amateur coaches do have it a lot harder than you do in the top flight level in terms of players. That day of the awards, my second row dropped out of the Saturday fixture because he'd cut his hand open with a chainsaw because he's a tree surgeon. And, you know, we struggled to have the players to come in and replace him when, you know, if that happened for Southgate, he could just go and pick any top Premiership player to come in and do it. So, you know, there's different circumstances can influence different things, and I think getting amateur coaches recognition on that level, I think, was a huge buzz for every amateur coach out there, that, you know, you can take on the elite and you know, be successful.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's such a good story. So now we've got to get into the meat and bones of it, of that 2017-18 season. What, tell me how it went, how it progressed, what were some of the ups and downs and some of the big moments that you think led to the club's success in Twickenham at the end?
Well, a lot of it for me came to how we approached the program from the very beginning. So like I said earlier, you know, I knew the players at the club. They necessarily didn't know me, but I'd watched them play before. I knew what to expect. I knew what they had, but I wanted to really get to know the players a little bit more, and it was sort of influenced by some of my course about, you know, understanding who you're coaching. So I was quite inspired by the vice chancellor here at Leeds, Beckett. He came in and did talk to us about when he took over and how he wanted to get to know his staff, and he sent a 10 question survey out to all staff to fill in. So I adapted them questions and sent them out to the players to really get an understanding of why they were Otleyensians, why they played rugby, and what their ambitions were, but also what they felt the key development points were for that year that they needed to address. So some of them said, you know, they wanted to play with the mates. It was a family orientated club. It was amateur. It was social. You know, these common themes came out. But then they all agreed that they wanted promotion. They wanted to get to Twickenham, and they realised that they'd been underachieving. And then in terms of what they wanted around that, it was a playing style. It was a more structured defence, just an idea of what they were doing, where they were doing it, and how they were going to do it. So that sort of shaped how we delivered pre-season after that, really. And it kicked on from there. Not many players joined the club. I brought down a hooker. A seven came from Otley, who'd been playing first team there, wanted a bit more of a social experience. And, you know, they added just a little bit more experience to the pack. But other than that, the playing squad was fairly similar. And I suppose one of the key moments is, I sort of said earlier about how we conceded 511 points the year before. Last season, the total points conceded was 278. So that was an average of 11 points a game. So we really managed to cut that down.
And what do you attribute that to?
A general understanding of a defensive system. I think the lads could all play rugby, but we sort of tried to bring their game intelligence on a little bit. And we focused on real two or three key things. So one was trying to win the ball back in five phases.
Yeah.
So whenever we go into a game, that's the objective, trying to stop them from playing for five. And then in our defensive structure, one thing I'd taken from the rugby program manager here, Kerry Wood, was around connection and communication. So if we've always got that connection, communication and connection in defence, then teams are going to struggle to get through us. And we sort of applied them all year, and teams just struggled to break us down.
Standard answer to any rugby question that you ask is communication. How do you specify that a little bit more? And how do you what do you mean by connection? What's that look like? How do you coach it?
Yeah, I suppose if a player used communication in a session to me, I'd always say it's a bit of a cop out because it is. But with connection, it's just making sure that we're not seeing any triangles within the defensive line.
Okay.
So if someone's either rushing out and leaving a gap in behind, or if someone's being lazy and staying behind, we've just got that full line coming up together. It's like a daisy chain.
Yeah.
We don't want to see a break in that daisy chain. And then communication, we tried to limit it to whether we were going to drift or whether we were going to press.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a hammer call where we come off the line and as a sort of press and then drift if we were going to push out and drift, use the touch line and take the space away that way. So it was up and out. So we just really tried to simplify the complexity.
Right. And what about around the breakdown? Did you have anything specific that was you think helped? Did players have license to you know, go on their own and take an opportunity if they saw it?
Yeah, so I'm always trying to encourage the players to make their own decisions. So we had a performance model of how we wanted to play, and that was heavily influenced by the pitch, as it were. But the decisions that they made within the game, they were sort of free to do. I'm really keen on not them being over. We were structured, but not overstructured, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So there was a theme for each part of the pitch. We broke it down into sort of a blue, which is in our own 22, an amber, which was the middle of the field up to the opposition 22, and then the green.
Mm.
So the objective in the blue was gain territory and attack and prevent scoring defence.
Mm.
In midfield, it was progress the ball forward and pressurise attack and defence. So get the ball forward in attack and pressurise in defence. And then in the green, it was to score. In defence, it was to maintain territory, so try and force an error from them so we stay up that side of the field.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of taken just so there was they had clarity of what they expected in each part of the field was, and they had certain common language that they used within that around what defence is. You know, if it was on at the breakdown, the players could shout fire and then the blitz and try and get the turnover that way, or ice means we just fill the field, take the space away, and you know we try and have a different plan. So ideally in the blue we'd have 15 blocks on feet, 30 feet on the floor, let's just take the space away.
Yeah it sounds a lot like some of the message I give when I'm coaching defense is you know let's refer to it as attack without the ball instead of defense, and that your ultimate goal is to get the ball back. And you know you can measure some stuff around that and set some really simple kind of goals and parameters around just getting the ball back, and it takes away the mystique a little bit from defense, I feel.
Yeah, 100%. I think it goes back to trying to simplify the complexity of it a little bit. At the end of the day, when you're defending, it could be the hardest couple of minutes of the game for certain moments. You've got to really work hard to get the ball back, and we talked about manic line speed. If we've got a full defensive line and we've got, you know, men on feet and we can get that communication and connection and get off the line with speed and take that space away, that's really challenging the decisions that the attacking player has to make. And the less time he's got, the more chance he's going to make an error, which more likely win the ball back within five phases. And we sort of had that mentality going into every game. You know, if we want to win the ball back in five phases, let's really work hard to do it. And then when we've got the ball in attack, we can, you know, we control the speed of the game. We don't let teams try and control us. And last year, we had quite a lot of success with it. An average of 11 points conceded a game is fairly good numbers. So it worked. It worked fairly well.
Absolutely. Staying on that season, are there any like real kind of defining moments in the year where you go, okay, that was, if that didn't happen, we may not have gotten the success we achieved?
There was a couple really. We played one of our local rivals, Leeds Modernians, at home. They're coached by a good friend of mine, Adam. And you know, they were sort of the club's bogey team a little bit. Because of the rivalry, players tend to play on emotion, and you know, we showed real calmness. We showed real game intelligence. And we just absolutely, from the scrum to the line out to backfield play to ball in hand, we just didn't give them any time on the ball. We showed such good clarity of everything that we'd spoke about up until that point. And it just worked. And you just go, yeah, this is working. This is what we want to come into a game like this, which, you know, had a big, not as big as a semi-final, but a reasonably big crowd for us down because of the nature of it. And we managed to perform like we did. You go, that's, yes, this is it.
Yeah,
and then
it's huge.
For me, the other one was actually the final. That's probably the best rugby we played all year.
Wow, that's great.
The conditions suited us. It was dry, it was sunny, it was Twickenham, there was a crowd. But everything that we'd done from pre-season up to that moment, the lads put into practice, especially in that first half, where we could have got another 3 or 4 tries, I think. I think nerves got the better of us, but how we got into shape, how we moved the ball to a wide channel. That was sitting in the coach's box, just watching you just go, yes, this is what we've worked to. This is the moment. This is everything coming together.
Sweet. So you got to now lobby Twickenham to play there every 2 weeks.
I'd love it. Yeah, it'd be great. I think they'd struggle to get the spectators down to watch. But I'm quite fortunate. I've been there 5 times, 4 as a coach, once as a player. And every time I go down within that and you do the full game day routine, it's special. You know, the RFU are quite good at making sure that if you're there for a game, it's like every other game from the internationals down. So you get the, cool. You walk through the Lions gate, you walk into to the tunnel, you do, everything's like it, the pros will get it. And that's really special for the players because, like I say, I'm quite lucky, I've done it a few times, but for them, that could be their only time.
Yeah,
and they, you know, it's good the way they are if you do that.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Cool. What about practice design? What do you think you brought into the club that year that maybe was new to the players, that was pretty fresh and interesting and really helped push the team forward?
Well, I think a lot of it goes down to sort of some of the stuff I did on my masters around understanding the game of rugby.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of influenced by what they call sort of a mental model, which is a lady called Pam Richards has done quite a lot of research on it, especially within netball, about how having a performance model can add, simplify the complexity of moments of the game to make decisions for players that little bit easier.
Okay.
So going back to what I said earlier around the red, amber, the blue, amber, green.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of really what built up our coaching sessions. So we'd use games-based practice to replicate certain ways that we could deliver exit sets, or how we would play in the middle for third, or how we would look to play in the green to score.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd adapt and constrain games to sort of suit that.
Yeah.
So the players would have creative freedom in terms of what they were doing. They'd try and hit our key focus areas for that point. But everything was related back to our curriculum of the mental model, so that the players got onto the field and the pitch, because the pitch in rugby massively dictates what you want to do and how you want to do it.
Mm.
And making them aware of how you can use the pitch to your advantage. And I think that just helped us keep the ball, move the ball forward, and then add pressure to the opposition.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was through games, but the games were heavily connected to our mental model.
Right.
And we do some practice skills on hands, you know, 2v1, 3v2s, some I suppose known as drilled games, but with the purpose of just fine-tuning a few bits of technical skill.
Mm-hmm.
But predominantly games-based stuff, just really trying to recreate the moments within a game that the players are going to have on a match day.
No, that's cool. And while we're on your masters there, what were some of the other big rocks theoretically that you took from that experience when you took a year out that you then applied to the club?
Well, that module in itself is called Understanding and Analyzing Sports Performance.
Right.
And Pam came in and did a talk to us on a research within netball around that was specifically around the centre pass. Paul Heckenbottom, who was the Barnsley football manager at Leeds and now at Hibs in Scotland, he'd done the masters and he'd come in and talked about how he'd applied that to his environment as well.
Mm, right.
And just hearing these practical examples of how they've gone into their their own environments and applied some of the theories and concepts. That really was quite powerful for me, because I think one of the bonuses I had is through taking sort of 9 years out of education and actually being a practitioner. Whenever we were taught something, I tried to think about how I could apply that myself. Mm. Because at the end of the day, one of the key things they were pushing is what works for whom, in what circumstance, and why. So, you know, yeah, we're giving you all this information, but don't just go and throw it all in there and, you know, like verbal diarrhea. Just get it, as much of this content as you can get out there. Work what works best for you, or use what works best for you. So that was quite important. And then the other one was sort of really getting an understanding of who you're coaching, what you're coaching, and how you're going to coach it. Mm. So if you can, you know, you understand your participants, you can understand the curriculum of what you want to try and get out of that through your performance model, and then understanding key simple bits of pedagogy to deliver it. And then you plan, you deliver, and then you review. But those were quite big learning moments for me, really.
So those
were probably the key things. It was a really powerful 2 years, really learning about that, and using all the knowledge that I had from my RFU days to try and create my own way that I could deliver that at Otley.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Sounds fascinating and really interesting. After the big year, and I'm sure they've got the statue ready to put out of you out the front of the clubhouse. How's the club going this year after promotion and winning the award?
That's a bit of an anti-climax, really, because we're actually struggling a little bit. And that's not... it's more down last year when you've got a big carrot like Twickenham to motivate individuals for, you suddenly find that when it's raining and there's a wind chill of -4 that you still have 30 lads training. But last year we didn't have hardly any injuries, and this year it's sort of gone a role reversal. And we've had loads of injuries, and we've not had the depth as a senior club to be able to combat that. So in terms of league performance, we have struggled. We can still turn it around. There's 4 games left, 20 points to play for, and we can still get out of the relegation battle that we find ourselves in. But we've not disgraced ourselves in terms of performance. We've played really well. I think one of the positives from last year's success was we had sort of a merge of two teams came together for a Colts age group. So under-17s they're playing. And they're based out of our club now.
That's right.
Because they sort of had two, they're mixture of numbers. So rather than, you know, just folding the club and one going to one club and then the other one having a bit of history, they just came to us en masse as a bit of a venue for it.
Right.
And that's really kicked on. They've got 25 lads now that are playing. They're playing every Sunday, and they're playing in a mixture of Otley and Otleyensians colours. So there's the two clubs sort of merging together.
Cool.
Although the first team aren't particularly doing very well in terms of performance on the results-based performance. We're playing some good rugby, but we're not getting the wins. There's other positives that are happening for the club thanks to the success of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And chatting to other coaches that have had similar experiences of the Twickenham run, they always say the year after is the hardest one. Because some lads at the end of the season go, well, what can I achieve now? I've sort of hit my pinnacle for me. I'm not going to go and do that every year. I'm not going to go on and be a National League player. I'm level 8, level 7, level 9. I might just, you know, call it a day. So it's difficult to get them motivated to get going again. And our big loss was losing our fullback. He did his ACL just before pre-season started. So he's been out all year, and he's one of our main influences within the back line, and you know, being able to replace him has been quite difficult. So it's been a frustrating year, but there are positives to take out of it, and you know, I think the players will become stronger next year because of it.
You can't have those guys every year like that, and often you do get that, you know, slight blip in the radar post a really good run. And yeah, there's always learnings there. It's not as fun as the other way around.
No, it's not.
But there's a lot to get out of it.
I've been in relegation battles as a coach and a player before. So I was kind of aware going into it. But some of these lads, it's probably one of the worst seasons they've had in terms of results as a senior player for a while. And, you know, losing can be a bad habit to get out of.
Yeah.
And there's some games where we've actually played probably better than some of the opposition. But because confidence is low, you know, some things, you know, handball doesn't necessarily go to hand, or you knock it on just at the back of the breakdown at a key area of the field. And, you know, the players have worked hard trying to match that step up. And there's players who have been coming into the first team who probably wouldn't have been in the first team last year, but have not disgraced themselves. They've developed, they've pushed forward. And that for me as a coach is pleasing, that I can see that these players have developed into the level of that player. Is probably just coming around a little bit too late in terms of getting the results to keep us in potentially in that league. But yeah, it's been a difficult season for the players, myself, Steve and Harrison.
Yeah.
But you know, we've learned a lot from it. The players have learned a lot from it, and I think in the long run, we'll be better because of it.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing you're talking about there, because you know, I think every coach has kind of been through that, either the promotion or the relegation kind of theme there. And you said you've been through it a few times. I just finished watching Sunderland or Die the first season, and
on Netflix.
Yeah, it was pretty epic. Can't wait for the next one. But they seem to be constantly in that relegation battle. What do you find that has worked, like, when you realize, okay, we're at risk of being relegated here, we really need to just, like, narrow attention to this and this. What have you found that works at your end for that? Or is there anything?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think one of the key issues we had was getting the same team out every week because of injuries, unavailability, and general squad depth. It was quite. I think we've used 52 players in the first team this year, which is mad to get any form of continuity from that. Because then when people are changing all the time, you know, that makes it difficult for the wider plan to work. So I think if you can, to cope with the injuries and stuff that we have, you need a bigger squad with people who are willing to trade every week and play every week. And unfortunately, I think because of the nature of amateur sport, that's difficult to do once you start hitting a few difficult results. And I think that there's only so much as a coaching team that we can do in terms of putting sessions on and making them fun and engaging. But you know, when you've lost quite a few games in a row, it's difficult for the individual to get that motivation to come out on a wet, windy Tuesday or Thursday to come and put some stuff right. So I don't really know what the answer is to turning around it, really. I mean, you've just got to ride the storm and hope that, you know, things work out.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah, no, I don't know either. so it's just more that, yeah, I think you're right. There's you can try a few things and hope something sticks, but
I think with a lot of it, you got to be true to yourself as well as a coach. You know, everyone's got their own beliefs, concepts, and values that underpin you and your coaching and how you are. I think as long as you stay true to yourself and what you believe in, and you've got that buy-in from the players that you've got, I think that's really important. If you go a little bit rogue and start changing things left, right, and centre and be reactive, that then can have a negative impact on the environment that you're trying to create.
For sure.
And it's quite interesting from a winning point of view. There's been some research done about serial winning coaches by one of the senior lecturers here, and that they interviewed the coaches and the players about, you know, why you were able to become a serial winning coach. And they defined a serial winning coach as someone who had repeated success in different environments. So for example, someone like Ferguson, for example, wouldn't have been part of that study because he did it all in the same place. But someone like Pep Guardiola would fall into it. And they came out that the vision was really important, the environment was really important, people were really important, and the philosophy sort of sat in the middle of it. So I think as long as a coach who can have a real clear vision of what you want and they've got the buy-in, you create that environment that makes people want to learn, and you've got the right people around you through coaches, through medical, through the players as well, then, you know, that can create a winning culture. And all it takes is for a little bit within that to break that chain, and then that's when you can get on a bit of a drop-off. And I think if you can keep them three things consistently, which is hard in amateur sport, then you can get onto a real winner. And that's one thing we tried to do last year. But there's just been too many changeable variables this year to maintain that throughout the year.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, that's good advice though, nonetheless. Last question before we wrap things up. One of your other roles is rugby development officer at Leeds Beckett University. What does that role look like on a day-to-day basis, and how do you enjoy that position?
Oh, it's I've got quite a great role here at the university. I'm working with Colin Stevens, former World International Barbarian, and Kerry Wood. He's the rugby program manager. Colin's director of rugby. Kerry's the Colin's director of rugby, Woody's the rugby program manager, and it's great working from them. You know, Woody's a level 4 coach, Carl's a former international, and getting information from them and learning from them from a coaching point of view is really good. But my role is a development officer, so I'm responsible for the recruitment and retention of players, not just at Leeds Beckett University. So I do a little bit of work with the University of Leeds and Leeds Trinity University as well, to make sure that the student platform of rugby is growing. So as an NGB, England Rugby have worked out that we have a huge drop off rate of students coming into university.
Mm-hmm.
They either stop playing or they go and do something else, and my role is try and engage as many of them as possible to keep them in the program. So there's a lot of development festivals that get organized. I'm responsible for our freshers trials here at Beckett, and then I'm supporting the University of Leeds with their intramural program, and Leeds Trinity with their social sport program as well. So that's sort of what the day-to-day stuff is. There's a bit of coaching. I coach the threes and fours, but then sort of there's a lot of admin to do alongside that with the development stuff. So I get the best of both worlds. I have to sit on a computer and do spreadsheets all day, but then in the night I get to go out and do some coaching with some young, talented players that are really ambitious to get into the first team, who play on a national level.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. That sounds a lot of fun. All right, then we always end the show with the same final four questions. When you were a kid growing up, who were some of the players that really, really stood out to you?
So now I've played the game since I was six, and I was it's quite a difficult question to answer because I probably didn't really start watching rugby properly until sort of I was 15, by which point I was heavily influenced by that England World Cup winning side in 2003. You know, you look at the players that were in that squad, you've got, you know, Jason Leonard, Mike Catt, Johnny Wilkinson, there's so many different players within that made that team successful, and I think they just inspired me to want to keep playing and want to try and be the best that I could and motivate me. Because I remember watching the World Cup final at home on, I think it was Sunday, and then I was playing rugby in the afternoon, sort of after all that hype. So I think it'll be difficult to name a specific player, but that whole squad of the 2003 World Cup just really inspired me to stay in the game, want to be better, and want to kick on from that, really. So yeah. I think it'd be difficult to name one player because that group, that squad that Clive Wood put together really just influenced me to want to keep within the game. There's just a good buzz about it. I think it was a good time to be watching.
Well, you're gonna have to hand in your Yorkshire passport, I think, because you didn't mention Jason Robinson in there.
Yeah. Jason, well, you know, he came from rugby league as well, and brought a lot of excitement to the thing. He was a very good player. I think World Rugby actually put a highlights reel up of him on Twitter the other day as well. So yeah, maybe I should have made sure I mentioned him in there.
just messing. Yeah, of course it was against Australia, but whatever. Just the two players for me there out of that era was Johnny and Jason Robinson. Just the feat on Jason Robinson was just incredible.
Well, his try in the final was unbelievable.
I can't remember.
You know, skip round conveniently.
Yeah. Cool. And what about now? Who are some of the players that you like watching?
I think there's quite a lot of talented players through the game at the moment. I mean, you look from an England point of view, I think Atoje is doing a massive job in promoting the second row a little bit. You know, there's when you're speaking to kids that are wanting to play rugby, everyone wanted to be the Johnny Wilkinson, you know, they wanted to be the kicker, the runner. And Atoje, as an example, just seems to be getting more people interested into the second row, same with Courtney Laws, you know, with the second row and back row. So, you know, they're a real good way of promoting a position that, you know, there's not many people that want to do it anymore. So you've got their work rate and what they're doing and being noticed is what's doing that. So there's obviously a lot of talent in there. And then you've got Borden Barrett, you've got Sexton, you know, again, just playing probably at the best of their games at the moment. And it's really exciting to see. I think it's probably the first World Cup in a while where you could look at it and go, there's probably five teams that could be pushing for it, really. And it's who's going to play best on that particular day that's going to dictate the result. So I think there's lots of exciting players out there. Be difficult again to name one, but I think I'm really impressed watching someone like Itoje at the moment and how he's running in the line, how he's doing in the loose. And for his age as well, I think he's got a very exciting career ahead of him.
Yeah, no, he's great.
Had a second row as well, I'm bound to say that. So.
Yeah, no doubt. Cool. And what about coaches? Who are some of the high profile coaches that you like what they're doing?
I've always been a fan of Stuart Lancaster. You know, he lives in Leeds, and I think you know how he turned that England squad around, bringing them back to Leeds, rediscovering you know why they were playing for their country after the World Cup, and built them up. And he didn't have a great 2015, but I think, you know, where the England squad is now is because of a lot of the foundations that Stuart put in place. I think you look at what he's doing at Leinster at the moment. You know, they're playing some really good rugby. They're exciting. They're and he is a good coach. You know, a few weeks after he'd finished the World Cup and had left England, he was down at my club, West Park Leeds at the time, and he actually did a session for our senior team on defence. We had 50 lads down, and that was a few weeks after the World Cup. So,
that's awesome.
You know, he's not only a good bloke, but he is a very good coach when you listen to him speak. And his leadership and his management that he brings to it, I think he's really good to speak to about coaching. And I think you've got to admire what he's done as well, bouncing back from 2015 to go and do what he's doing at Leicester.
Love to get him on the show for sure. And I think what stands out,
he'd probably do it as well.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt it. He just seems like that bloke, right? And anyone who's worked with him, like from what I've heard and read in papers and that kind of stuff, no one's got a bad word to say about him. It's all praise.
No,
even then,
After he'd done that defensive session for me, he followed that up with an attacking session, and we sent him some of the videos. He clipped them. He came down and did a review, and then went outside and did a bit of an attack play. He came down and watched us play on a Saturday. That was before he did a bit of a tour of the Southern Hemisphere. But he's he's a good bloke. He's a good coach, and I think, you know, to bounce back, he got a bit of a slating in the media here after the World Cup in 2015, and you know, I don't think a lot of it was fair in my opinion. And I think to brush that off, to bounce back and to go to a club like Leinster and you know, go on and be European champions, you know, it just shows that he is a good coach. He does know what he's doing, and I think it's a testament to him as a person as well.
Yeah, totally agree. Cool. And then last question, who's someone in your local area who's doing good work and deserves a bit of a shout out?
There's probably two, to be fair, really. I mean, there's Harrison, who's currently coaching with me at Otley Enzians. He's 23, I think, is Harrison. He's just finished his undergrad. He's now doing the Masters in Sports Coaching that I did. But he played academy rugby with Northampton before he came to university, and he's got a good knowledge of the game. And I just think if I had his knowledge that he's got now when I was his age, I'd probably be a bit further on now than where I am in my career. He's learned a lot over the last 12 months. It was his first year of coaching last year with us, so he's had a great year to put on his CV as a national player, so he's got some good stuff on the CV. But he applies it really well. He's a logical thinker, and his deliveries come on over the last 12 months a lot as well. The other one, although he'd probably be annoyed because he is a coach, but he is more on the academic side of things, is a guy called Mike Ashford, who's one of the PhD students here at Leeds Beckett. Mike's really doing some really good research around the decisions that players make within games. Cool. And how we can try and do sessions and adapt sessions to match some of them. So I think he's done some stuff with Russell Earnshaw recently when I was being on the show a couple of times. Mm. But his research is I think it will be quite a game changer in terms of how we can adapt our practice for sessions. And he's doing some stuff with some of the professional clubs now for his data capture and just how we can, yeah, just empower players to make them decisions in the game. And he's a good coach as well. He applies it really, really well. He's very highly regarded, especially within the rugby club here at Leeds Beckett, for what he does when he's on the field. He motivates the lads, he empowers them, and he's doing some really good stuff at Harrogate Rugby Club at the moment. So yeah, I've got, you know, me and Mike spent at least once a week, sit down and have a coffee and put the world to rights about rugby, and I've learned a lot from him, and you know, we just like sharing ideas. And yeah, I think if he was to, when he's finished his PhD, just kick on with his coaching, I think he would go quite far in, especially within an academy structure. I think he'd do really well within that.
All right, awesome. One to watch for sure. All right, Chris, well, it's been awesome talking to you about the experience that you and your club went through, and the highs and lows, and also some of the theory from your post-grad degree. I think listeners are going to get a bunch out of it. I definitely have. And yeah, really appreciate you giving up your time to come on the show.
No problem, mate. Happy to do it.
All right, cheers, mate.
Thanks for listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review via iTunes and keep listening for the next episode. You can also follow us via Twitter at RugbyCoachesCNR or via the website therugbycoachescorner.com. Until next time, keep sharing ideas to make the game better.